The Great Second Advent Movement by J.N. Loughborough, Chapter 27. Other testimonies confirmed. Jehoshaphat stood and said, "Hear me, O Judah, and ye inhabitants of Jerusalem. Believe in the Lord your God, so shall ye be established. Believe his prophets, so shall ye prosper." 2 Chronicles 20:20. Years ago, a testimony was given through the gift of prophecy that before the end, the printed pages of this truth would be scattered like the autumn leaves. How this could be accomplished unless the people believing the truth were in some way organized or marshaled to do the work was the question that arose in the minds of many. In God's providence, great results are frequently achieved from most humble beginnings. So it was in the development of a system of working that arose among us. The Track in Missionary Society. About the year 1870, the idea of a track and missionary society was first suggested by the course of a few devoted sisters at South Lancaster, Massachusetts. These sisters tried for a time the plan of mailing our denominational papers and tracts to different persons outside of our faith, afterward writing them letters. This resulted in several individuals accepting the truth, which brought to the mind of Elder S. N. Haskell the question, why may not all our people engage in doing what a few sisters have done? During the year 1871, especially, this subject was agitated more or less through the columns of the Review. At the special session of the General Conference, held December 29, 1871, Elder Haskell, being present and setting forth the practical utility of the movement, a resolution was passed recommending the formation of tract societies. Elders S. N. Haskell, W. H. Littlejohn, J. N. Andrews, J. H. Wagner, and I. D. Van Horn were appointed as a committee to perfect plans for the formation of such societies. This movement introduced a new era in the prosecution of the work of the message. Hitherto, the teaching of the truth had been confined almost exclusively to efforts put forth by the living preacher. For several years, Elder Haskell labored very assiduously in studying up and introducing plans for making the Track and Missionary Society a success. It is only doing justice to him to state that he was really the pioneer in that line. This is not only true in the matter of the state track and missionary societies, but it was he who, in 1878, introduced to the General Conference assembled in Battle Creek the plan for a general, since called international, track society, whose field of labor is the territory outside of our conferences, not only in America, but also in foreign countries. Efficient secretaries. Maria Huntley. The Lord in his providence raised up efficient secretaries who were a great assistance to Elder Haskell in this movement. Sister Maria Huntley was one who labored unflinchingly, even under, in after years, great affliction of body, and fell at her post about 14 years ago. Through her efforts, many of the present openings in foreign fields were first found. Other secretaries have joined in the same work, and as the field of labor has been enlarged, a necessity has arisen for secretaries in different languages. The effect on local churches. But the most important result of the establishment of the Tract Society work among us has been the influence which it has exerted in the direction of creating and increasing a missionary spirit among the local church organizations. It has given everyone an opportunity to do something by correspondence and the distribution of reading matter and to feel the inspiration of direct labor for the salvation of souls. Testimony relating to tract work. To show the nature of the instruction given through the spirit of prophecy on the subject of the track and missionary work, we quote from Testimonies number 29 and 30, quote, "If there is one work more important than another, it is that of getting our publications before the public, thus leading them to search the Scriptures. Missionary work, introducing our publications into families, conversing and praying with and for them, is good work, and one which will educate men and women to do pastoral labor. Not everyone is fitted for this work. Those of the best talent and ability who will take hold of the work understandingly and systematically and carry it forward with persevering energy are the ones who should be selected. There should be a most thoroughly organized plan, and this should be faithfully carried out. Churches in every place should feel the deepest interest in the track and missionary work. The track and missionary work is a good work. It is God's work. It should be in no way belittled, but there is continual danger of perverting it from its true object. Canvassers are wanted to labor in the missionary field. Persons of uncouth manners are not fitted for this work. Men and women who possess tact, good address, keen foresight, and discriminating minds, and who feel the value of souls, are the ones who can be successful." Close quote. The disposal of over $8 million worth of books, pamphlets, and tracts during 12 years by our churches and canvassers goes far as proof of the practical value of the work of the Tract and Missionary Society. Prophecy versus Worldly Wisdom. There was a word of prophecy given in connection with the work in the European field, which is being so literally fulfilled that it merits notice at this point. It was affirmed by laborers and people that the work could not be carried on there, especially in Scandinavia, as it is in America. Mrs. White, to their surprise, said it not only could be carried on successfully, but could be sustained in the same way it was in America, and that the Lord had shown her that if they took hold to pay their tithe, even of the small earnings they received, God would prosper them far beyond their anticipations. She also told them that canvassers could sell books by subscription in Scandinavia, and it would be a success. Managers of publishing houses in those countries said it cannot be done. They never sold books in that way. The sequel has shown that what the angel of the Lord presented to her in this matter was far superior to the wisdom of the worldly booksellers and publishers. Success has attended the canvassing work there from its very beginning. Some of those who moved out to pay to the cause a tenth of their scanty income have become canvassers, and not only sustained themselves, but earn more means than ever before, and consequently are enabled to pay a much greater tithe. More than $40,000 worth of books were sold by the canvassers in the year 1895 of works printed in our publishing house in Kristiania, Norway. Mark this as another prophecy fulfilled, and that, too, in the face of protestations on every hand, both in the church and out of it, that it could not be done. In reference to the work of the tract societies, which were instituted in 1871 and onward, it is safe to say that almost as many persons have been brought to the truth by the efforts of such workers as through the personal efforts of the ministry. Through this agency, the message is being published to all nations and tongues of the earth. Jewelry and the track work. An interesting item was reported by the Track and Missionary Society in California in April 1873. It was that the jewelry, which had been donated to the society by those who had accepted the truth in that state up to that date, had been melted, assayed, and sold at its actual gold and silver value for the sum of $200. that this means had all been invested in tracts, pamphlets, and periodicals which had been distributed, and that the society already had definite knowledge of 20 who had been brought to the acceptance of the truth by means of literature purchased with proceeds of the jewelry. Among those brought to the knowledge of the truth by reading was John I. Tay of Oakland, California. San Francisco, a missionary point. In 1875, an important testimony was given to the San Francisco Church, to which attention is now called because of its being so strikingly fulfilled. This church, from the first, had been under the necessity of renting halls for services, and that, too, at considerable expense and some inconvenience, as no series of meetings could be held in them because much of the time they were required for other purposes. On the evenings of April 14 and 20, 1875, the leading members of the San Francisco Church were called together at the house of Mrs. J. L. James, 5th Street, near Market Street, and Mrs. White there related to us what had been shown her in vision concerning the situation, which was that San Francisco would ever be a missionary point where the work could be carried on, and that souls would, if the matter was managed judiciously, continue to accept the truth. If a house of worship was erected where the people could be invited and where labor could be put forth, souls would be added to their number, who, in their turn, would help to meet the expense and lift the debt which must be incurred in preparing a meeting house. Mrs. White continued by saying that she had seen that when she should urge upon the San Francisco Church the importance of erecting a house of worship, it would look to that poor church like a move in the dark, but she was bidden to say that as they moved out, they would see the providence of God opening the way before them step by step, and that friends would be raised up all along the way, until finally the debt would be entirely taken up. Being one of the few who met in the meetings already referred to, I can say that the idea of that company, who were nearly every one of them of the poor of this world, taking hold to erect a meeting house 35 by 80 feet, and that, too, in a city where the least expense for a lot seemed to demand an outlay of at least $6,000, looked indeed like a move in the dark. They were induced to make the move only by the full confidence that they had the testimony borne to them by Mrs. White that was from the Lord and would surely be accomplished. Having been connected with the enterprise more or less from its inception until the present, I wish here to state that the above testimony has been fulfilled in every particular. When we started out in quest of lots, we succeeded in obtaining a $6,000 lot for $4,000. One sister said she would give $1,000 if she could sell her place. She immediately put the property into the hands of a real estate agent, who told her the price was too low. Within 2 weeks, her place was sold for $1,000 more than she had first valued it, and her pledge was paid. Another poor brother, who did not see how the church could be built, but said, quote, "If the Lord says it must be done, he will open the way somehow," close quote, found to his astonishment the estate of one of his relatives settled up, and that he was the possessor thereby of $20,000. He gave $1,000 toward the building and bought one-third of the church lot on which to place a residence for himself, thus in two ways bringing relief to the society. A significant favor to San Francisco. Thus we might mention many donations and favors which the committee met as they went with the erection of the building. Suffice it to say that the church edifice was put up at an expense with lot of about $14,000, over one half of which was met by donations before the house was finished. Laguna Street, on which the building was erected, being a section of the city where there was a lack of buildings for school purposes, the school board came to rent the lower rooms in which to hold the school before the roof was on the house. $75 rent per month, received for nearly 2 years, met the interest and the running expenses, leaving the society to apply what it could raise toward the remaining debt. A hydriatric dispensary. At the present time, a small part of the debt then incurred remains, and in the basement of the church, a full-equipped hydriatric dispensary is found, all free from pecuniary embarrassment of much greater value than the remaining debt, which will soon be a matter of the past. The part of the testimony concerning souls accepting the truth has been most wonderfully fulfilled. Not simply scores, but hundreds have received the light of the truth in that city, and are now scattered abroad in various parts of the earth. From time to time, as I visit San Francisco, I see anywhere from 2 to 10 persons who have accepted the truth since last I met with them, and the end is not yet. Elder White's death. About the year 1880, Mrs. White was instructed through the spirit of prophecy to say to her husband, Elder James White, that he should lay off many of the cares and responsibilities he had borne and let them pass into other and younger hands, while he should prepare for his last change, meaning that his earthly race was soon to close. This instruction he began to heed, and none too soon, for in the year 1881 his labors ceased, and he fell asleep in Jesus. July 31, he was attacked with malarial fever. August 3, he was removed from his home to the Battle Creek Sanitarium, where he received every care and attention which it was possible to give, but to no avail. He continued to grow worse. From the first of his illness, he had a premonition that his last change had come. Elder Smith's statement. In speaking of this event, Elder Uriah Smith says, quote, "The circumstances of his death could hardly have been more favorable. So long as he was conscious, during the last 3 days of his illness, he testified that he suffered no pain. A large company of sincere and tearful friends stood in and about the building while on that pleasant Sabbath afternoon his life ebbed slowly away. Like falling into a quiet sleep, so he went down in death, and when all was over, a sweet peace seemed to sit embalmed on every feature. It was as if this prayer had been answered. Spare me this hour to sleep, before thy sleepless bliss is given. Give me a day of rest on earth, before the work of heaven." At the time of his death, he was 60 years and 2 days old. The esteem in which he was held in Battle Creek was evinced in the fact that at least 2,500 people were present at his funeral. August 13, and he was followed to his last resting place in Oak Hill Cemetery by a procession of 95 carriages and a multitude of people on foot. From the many testimonials given after his death and published in the review, we quote the following from the pen of Elder S. N. Haskell, quote, "When I consider his sound judgment in almost every emergency, his tenderness of heart and nobility of soul manifested toward the erring, and even toward those who had abused him, whenever he saw evidences of their repentance and his love for what he believed to be right, I can truly say, a father in Israel has fallen. And while he rests, the cause, as well as many individuals, will realize the want of his foresight and fatherly care." Close quote. When he died, our enemies claimed that the message must now stop. Not so. Those institutions which, under the divine hand, had been established by him, were destined to grow to still greater magnitude, to be as trees of the Lord's planting, from which should spread forth numerous and fruitful branches. Religious legislation predicted. 50 years have passed since those giving the third angel's message said the time would come, according to the prophecy of Revelation 13, when people would be persecuted in the United States and elsewhere for keeping the commandments of God. In a book written by Mrs. White entitled Early Writings, we read the following concerning this teaching. Quote, said the angel, look ye, my attention was turned to the wicked or unbelievers. They were all astir. The zeal and power with the people of God had aroused and enraged them. Confusion was on every side. I saw measures taken against the company who had the light and power of God. Darkness thickened around them, yet they stood firm, approved of God, and trusting in Him. I saw them perplexed. Next I heard them crying unto God earnestly. Day and night their cry ceased not. Thy will, O God, be done. If it can glorify thy name, make a way of escape for thy people. Deliver us from the heathen round about us. They have appointed unto us death, but thine arm can bring salvation. Close quote, Early Writings, page 272. Quote, then I saw the leading men of the earth consulting together, and Satan and his angels busy around them. I saw a writing, copies of which were scattered in different parts of the land, giving orders that unless the saints should yield their peculiar faith, give up the Sabbath, and observe the first day of the week, the people were at liberty after a certain time to put them to death. Close quote, Early Writings, pages 282 to 283. Persecution in America. Our opponents have said persecution could never come in this country because the Constitution of the United States declares that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. In addition to this, the Bill of Rights of most of the states forbids religious legislation. In the face of these protestations, our people have continued to proclaim the message of warning and the needful preparation to meet the conflict. In 1863, an organization was formed having for its object the change of the Constitution of the United States and the laws of the land so as to make it effective for the enforcement of religion. So rapidly have these ideas obtained adherence and the principle of compelling men to do right, especially in regard to Sunday keeping, gained ground that persecution in good earnest has already begun in many states, even those whose Sunday laws make provision for those who conscientiously observe another day, and persons have been imprisoned for not keeping Sunday. 116 arrests. Before me is a list of 116 arrests of Seventh-day Adventists in America from the year 1878 to March 1896. Of these, 109 were convicted. Many of these have been in prison from 20 to 60 days, and about a dozen of them were compelled to work in the chain gang with murderers, thieves, and the worst sort of criminals. In every case, they were admitted by those imposing sentence upon them to be the best of citizens. The Religious Liberty Association. On July 21, 1889, there was organized in Battle Creek, Michigan, an association called the National Religious Liberty Association, the object of which was to oppose religious legislation, to disseminate information to the masses on the true relation of religion and civil government, and to render aid to those who are persecuted for conscience' sake. This association did a vast amount of work in the dissemination of literature and in enlightening the people as to the duties and dangers of the times in our own nation. In fact, it did a great work in extending the notes of warning contained in the messages of Revelation 14, verses 9 through 12. The help of secular journals. The persecutions that were then raging against Seventh-day Adventists were taken up in the editorial columns of such papers as the New York Sun, the New York World, the Chicago Inter-Ocean, etc. articles appeared speaking out freely concerning the unjust course taken against a citizen of the United States for obeying his own conscience and for keeping the very day designated in the commandment. By means of newspaper articles of that character, this subject was brought before millions of readers. Within 1 month, the central truth of the third angel's message was brought to the attention of more people than we had been able to reach in more than 20 years. The wrath of man made to praise the Lord. Thus it is seen that the efforts of men to stay the work of God and to obtain laws for the support of a rival Sabbath to the one enjoined in the fourth commandment have served to open the way for the more rapid advancement of the truth. In meditating upon what has been accomplished in a few months by these means, two scriptures are forcibly brought to mind. One reads, "We can do nothing against the truth, but for the truth." 2 Corinthians 13, verse 8. And the other, "Surely the wrath of man shall praise thee, the remainder of wrath shalt thou restrain." Psalm 76, verse 10. Prediction concerning Sunday laws. In testimony number 32, printed in 1885, is a statement as to how Sunday laws would be passed in the United States. It reads, quote, "To secure popularity and patronage, legislators will yield to the demand for a Sunday law." Close quote. Testimonies for the Church, Volume 5, Number 32, page 451. We will for a moment consider how this has already been accomplished. World's Fair legislation. In 1892, a demand was made of Congress to prohibit the opening of the World's Fair, which was to be held in Chicago, Illinois, from May to October of that year, from opening on Sunday. Such a law was passed July 19, 1892, under just such pressure as above predicted. And be it remembered that this is the first time that the Congress of the United States of North America ever legislated on the Sabbath question. The churches sent in immense lists of names and petitions and telegrams, not only petitioning Congress, but kindly informing the congressmen, quote, "that we do hereby pledge ourselves and each other that we will, from this time henceforth, refuse to vote for or support for any office or position of trust, any member of Congress, either senator or representative, who shall vote for any further aid of any kind for the World's Fair except on conditions named in these resolutions." Close quote. The conditions were that the fair should be closed on Sunday. Talks in Congress, 1892. As a sample of the talk on the floors of Congress when the bill was passed, read the following, quote, "I should like to see the disclaimer put in white and black and proposed by the Congress of the United States. Write it. How would you write it? Word it, if you dare. Advocate it, if you dare. How many who voted for it would ever come back here again? None, I hope. You endanger yourselves by opposing it." Close quote. Boast made by the church that those who have demanded and secured of Congress the passage of this bill considered it an important victory in their scheme of religious legislation is clear from the fact that one of these prominent ministers, in a sermon at Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, just after it said, quote, "that the church has weight with great political or governing bodies has been demonstrated most effectively in the late World's Fair matter, when the United States Senate, the highest body in the country, listened to the voice of religion and passed the World's Fair $5 million appropriation bill with the church-instituted proviso that the gates of the Great Exposition should not be opened on Sunday. That grand good fact suggests to the Christian's mind that if this may be done, so may other equally needful measures. The church is gaining power continually, and its voice will be heard in the future much more oftener than in the past. Close quote. Thus we see how that testimony given in 1885 has been and is being fulfilled. Catholic and Protestant unity. In this connection, we will refer to another prediction made in 1885 and found also in testimony number 32. Quote, when Protestantism shall stretch her hand across the gulf to grasp the hand of the Roman power, when she shall reach over the abyss to clasp hands with spiritualism, when under the influence of this threefold union, our country shall repudiate every principle of its constitution as a Protestant and Republican government, and shall make provisions for the propagation of papal falsehoods and delusions, then we may know that the time has come for the marvelous workings of Satan, and that the end is near. Close quote. Testimonies for the Church, Volume 5, Number 32, page 451. To show how the first part of this prediction is already fulfilling, we need only to call attention to what is transpiring around us. See Protestants, both ministers and people, courting the favor of the Catholics, inviting them to attend their associations, etc. Be it remembered that hardly a vestige of what is now seen in this line was apparent in 1885 when the above testimony was given. To illustrate how the Protestants are reaching for the hand and help of papists, I quote from the Kansas City, Missouri Star of March 18, 1896, Methodists and St. Patrick's Day. A speech was delivered in Coates Opera House, Kansas City, Missouri, on St. Patrick's Day, March 17, 1896, by Dr. Mitchell, pastor of the leading Methodist Church of Kansas City. The Star speaks of a portion of the speech as a dramatic little scene. Dr. Mitchell was loudly applauded when he said this, quote, bigotry is the child of ignorance. We are bigoted because we do not know our neighbors well enough. We Protestants have been taught to believe unutterable things of Catholics. Catholics have been taught to believe unutterable things of Protestants. Now we discover our mistaken notions of each other when we get close enough to look into each other's eyes and clasp each other's hands. If we only knew each other more, we would love each other better. We have stood apart and criticized. Shame upon the followers of the blessed Christ. All Christians have been redeemed by the same precious blood. We are sustained by the same divine grace and expect to reach the same heaven. Say, brothers, we had better be getting acquainted with each other down here. Close quote. The Star continues, quote, Dr. Mitchell then turned to Father Dalton, Catholic priest, who sat just behind him and reaching out his hand, said, here, Brother Dalton, is my hand. Father Dalton arose and clasped the extended hand, and as Dr. Mitchell shook it, he said, it would be an awful shame if, after having lived so long in the same city on earth, we should have to get an angel to introduce us to each other in heaven. Let us get acquainted here on earth. The audience applauded. And after Father Dalton sat down, Dr. Mitchell continued his speech. Close quote. Something great and decisive. We quote from another communication dated Melbourne, Australia, February 18, 1892. Quote, all heaven is represented to me as watching the unfolding of events. A crisis is to be revealed in the great and prolonged controversy in the government of God on earth. Something great and decisive is to take place, and that right early. Close quote. Judge Brewer's Christian Nation. 11 days after this document was written, and before it reached the United States, an event occurred which both Protestants and Catholics referred to as decisive in this nation's destiny. I refer to the decision of the Supreme Court of the United States that, quote, "This is a Christian nation," close quote, rendered on the 29th of February by the Chief Justice Brewer. As already shown, on the 19th of July of the same year, the Sunday closing bill for the World's Fair was passed. The ministers, who pled so strongly for his passage, made earnest pleas on the ground that as the Supreme Court had declared this to be a Christian nation, as a matter of course, the Christian Sabbath should be protected from desecration. And so, the National Reform Party reasoned, as this is a Christian nation, it should recognize God and his laws as the basis of the government, etc. Truly, something great and decisive in this closing controversy did take place, and that right early. Ancient Prophets. Of the visions given to God's servants, the prophets, there seem to be two kinds. One called open vision, or those given where the individual could be seen while in the vision, and the other called night visions. References made to the former vision in 1 Samuel 3, verse 1, where is found the experience of the child Samuel in these words, quote, "The word of the Lord was precious in those days. There was no open vision," close quote. Open visions. It was a vision of this character, an open vision, in which the hand of the Lord was upon the prophet Ezekiel. As the elders of Judah sat before him, they beheld him in open vision. Ezekiel 8, verse 1. On another occasion, the prophet Daniel was taken off in vision in the midst of the Chaldean rulers. Had they remained, they might have seen him in vision, but instead, a great quaking fell upon them so that they fled to hide themselves. Daniel 10, verse 7. Night vision of Mrs. White. The earlier visions of Mrs. White were all open visions. Since 1884, the character of the visions has changed in this respect, as they are now what are called in the scriptures night visions, not simply dreams, but the same bright angel appears, giving her instruction, as in former years, in the open visions. Many instances of night visions are recorded in the Bible, as is readily seen by reading Genesis 46, 2, Daniel 2, 19, Daniel 7, 13, Acts 16, verse 9, Acts 18, verse 9, Acts 23, verse 11, and Acts 27, verses 23 to 25. In these night visions of Mrs. White, many important predictions have been made, which have been most accurately fulfilled as previously noted. Some of the views of a later date I will now notice. The removal to Washington. In 1893, Mrs. White said, quote, "Too many interests are now being piled up in Battle Creek. Were those interests divided and located in other cities, where the light and knowledge might bless other localities, it would be in God's order. The Lord does not want a second Jerusalem in Battle Creek. There will have to be strong reformations in transforming of facilities and institutions if the will of God is done." Close quote. At the General Conference in Oakland, California in March 1903, she said, quote, "For years the warning has been given to our people, get out of Battle Creek. But because of the many interests established there, it was convenient to remain, and men could not see why they should move." In reply to the question that has been asked in regard to settling somewhere else, I answer yes. Let the General Conference offices and the publishing work be removed from Battle Creek. I know not where the place will be, whether on the Atlantic coast or elsewhere, but this I will say, never lay a stone or a brick in Battle Creek to rebuild the review office there. God has a better place for it. Close quote. After hearing this instruction, the Conference of Believers voted, quote, that the General Conference offices be removed from Battle Creek, Michigan, to someplace on the Atlantic coast, close quote. In the General Conference Council held in Battle Creek, following the session of the General Conference, it was voted that we favor locating the headquarters of the General Conference office in the vicinity of New York City. A large committee was accordingly selected to search for a feasible location. The committee communicated their plan to Mrs. White and asked if she had further light for them. In reply, she said, quote, may the Lord help us to move understandingly and prayerfully. I am sure that he is willing that we should know, and that right early, where we should locate our publishing house. I am satisfied that our only safe course is to be ready to move just when the cloud moves. Let us pray that he will direct us. He has signified by his providence that he would have us leave Battle Creek. New York needs to be worked, but whether our publishing house should be established there, I cannot say. I should not regard the light I have received as definite enough to favor the movement. Close quote. After spending nearly 2 weeks hunting about New York City and surrounding towns, the committee failed to find a suitable place for the publishing house. At this point, a letter came, dated May 30, in which Mrs. White said, quote, as our brethren search for a location for the Review and Herald publishing house, they are earnestly to seek the Lord. They are to move with great caution, watchfulness, and prayer, and with a constant sense of their own weakness. We must not depend upon human judgment. We must seek for the wisdom that God gives. In regard to establishing the institution in New York, I must say, be guarded. I am not in favor of its being near New York. I cannot now give all my reasons, but I am sure that any place within 30 miles of that city would be too near. Study the surroundings of other places. I am sure that the advantages of Washington, D.C. should be closely investigated. We should not establish this institution in a city nor in the suburbs of a city. It should be established in a rural district where it can be surrounded by land. Close quote. Prediction of favorable offer. With this information, the committee began prayerfully to look about Washington when a third letter came containing this instruction, quote, we have been praying for light regarding the location of our work in the East, and light has come to us in a very decided way. Positive light has been given me that there will be offered to us for sale places upon which much money has been expended by men who had money to use freely. The owners of these palaces die, or their attention is called to some other object, and the property is offered for sale at a very low price. From the light given me, I know that for the present, the headquarters of the Review and Herald should be near Washington. Close quote. The predicted location found. With this communication in hand, the committee began prospecting in the District of Columbia for a site. But no land could be found for less than $1,000 per acre. Finally, their attention was called to Tacoma Park. The following is the report of the committee. Quote, we found a tract of about 50 acres just outside the district, but within the city limits of Tacoma Park, that we could purchase for $6,000 or at the rate of $120 an acre. We gave this place thorough examination. We found that some years ago it was selected by a Boston physician for a sanitarium site. He is said to have expended about $60,000 in the purchase price and in clearing it of all the underbrush, logs, and rubbish. Financial difficulties prevented him from carrying out his plans, and the tract passed into the hands of a gentleman who held a mortgage on it at a cost to him of $15,000. the citizens of Tacoma Park, as represented by the mayor and some of the leading men, gave us a very hearty welcome to the place and assurances of friendly cooperation in carrying out our plans. In all our travels and searching, we found no other spot that fills so fully the specifications of the testimonies as this one. We believe the providence of God has led us to the place He would have us occupy. Close quote. In view of the many fulfillments of testimonies presented in this and former chapter, let us believe in the Lord our God, and so be established, and believe His prophet, and so prosper, that we may be prepared for the events yet in the future, and not be taken by them unawares. This is the end of chapter 27.